Part 1. The Rise of Stoicism. Chapter 1. Philosophy Takes an Interest in Life. There have probably always been philosophers, in some sense of the word. They were those individuals who not only asked questions, such as where did the world come from, where did people come from, and why are there rainbows, but more important, went on to ask follow-up questions. When told, for example, that the world was created by the gods, these proto-philosophers would have realized that this answer didn't get to the bottom of things. They would have gone on to ask why the gods made the world, how they made it, and, most vexatiously to those trying to answer their questions, who made the gods. However, and whenever it may have started, philosophical thinking took a giant leap forward in the 6th century BC. We find Pythagoras, 570 to 500 BC, philosophizing in Italy. Thales, 636 to 546 BC. Anaximander, 641 to 547 BC. And Heraclitus, 535 to 475 BC, in Greece. Confucius, 551 to 479 BC, in China. And Buddha, 563 to 483 BC, in India. It isn't clear whether these individuals discovered philosophy independently of one another, nor is it clear which direction philosophical influence flowed, if it indeed flowed. The Greek biographer Diogenes Laertius, from the vantage point of the 3rd century AD, offered an eminently readable, but not entirely reliable, history of early philosophy. According to Diogenes, early Western philosophy had two separate branches. One branch, he calls it the Italian branch, began with Pythagoras. If we follow through the various successors of Pythagoras, we ultimately come to Epicurus, whose own school of philosophy was a major rival to the Stoic school. The other branch, Diogenes calls it the Ionian branch, started with Anaximander, who, intellectually, pedagogically, begat Anaximenes, who begat Anaxagoras, who begat Archilius, who finally begat Socrates, 469 through 399 BC. Socrates lived a remarkable life. He also died a remarkable death. He had been tried for corrupting the youth of Athens and other alleged misdeeds, found guilty by his fellow citizens, and sentenced to die by drinking poison hemlock. He could have avoided this punishment by throwing himself on the mercy of the court, or by running away after the sentence had been handed down. His philosophical principles, though, would not let him do these things. After his death, Socrates's many followers not only continued to do philosophy, but attracted followers of their own. Plato, the best known of his students, founded the school of philosophy known as the Academy. Aristippus founded the Cyrenaic school. Euclides founded the Megarian school. Phaedo founded the Elean school, and Antisthenes founded the Cynic school. What had been a trickle of philosophical activity before Socrates became, after his death, a veritable torrent. Why did this explosion of interest in philosophy take place? In part because Socrates changed the focus of philosophical inquiry. Before Socrates, philosophers were primarily interested in explaining the world around them and the phenomena of that world, in doing what we would now call science. Although Socrates studied science as a young man, he abandoned it to focus his attention on the human condition. As the Roman orator, politician, and philosopher Cicero put it, Socrates was the first to call philosophy down from the heavens and set her in the cities of men and bring her also into their homes and compel her to ask questions about life and morality and things good and evil. The classicist, Francis MacDonald Cornford, describes Socrates's philosophical significance in similar terms. Pre-Socratic philosophy begins with the discovery of nature. Socratic philosophy begins with the discovery of man's soul. Why does Socrates remain an impressive figure 24 centuries after his death? It isn't because of his philosophical discoveries. His philosophical conclusions, after all, were basically negative. He showed us what we don't know. Rather, it was the extent to which he allowed his way of life to be affected by his philosophical speculations. Indeed, according to the philosopher Luis E. Navia, in Socrates, perhaps more than in any other major philosopher, we come upon the example of a man who was able to integrate in his life theoretical and speculative concerns into the context of his daily activities. Navia describes him as a veritable paradigm of philosophical activity, both in thought and in deed. Presumably, some of those drawn to Socrates were impressed primarily by his theorizing, while others were most impressed by his lifestyle. Plato belonged to the former group. In his academy, Plato was more interested in exploring philosophical theory than in dispensing lifestyle advice. Antisthenes, in contrast, was most impressed with Socrates' lifestyle. The Cynic school he founded eschewed philosophical theorizing and focused instead on advising people about what they must do to have a good life. It is as if Socrates, on his death, had fissioned into Plato and Antisthenes, with Plato inheriting Socrates' interest in theory and Antisthenes inheriting his concern with living a good life. It would have been wonderful if these two sides of philosophy had flourished in subsequent millennia, inasmuch as people benefit from both philosophical theorizing and the application of philosophy to their own life. Unfortunately, although the theoretical side of philosophy has flourished, the practical side has withered away. Under a despotic government such as that of ancient Persia, the ability to write, read, and do arithmetic was important for government officials, but the ability to persuade others wasn't. Officials needed only give orders, which those under their power would unhesitatingly obey. In Greece and Rome, however, the rise of democracy meant that those who were able to persuade others were most likely to have successful careers in politics or law. It was in part for this reason that affluent Greek and Roman parents, after a child's secondary education was completed, sought teachers who could develop their child's persuasive ability. These parents might have sought the services of a sophist, whose goal was to teach pupils to win arguments. To achieve this goal, sophists taught various techniques of persuasion, including both appeals to reason and appeals to emotion. In particular, they taught students that it was possible to argue for or against any proposition whatsoever. Along with developing pupils' argumentative skills, sophists developed their speaking skills, so they could effectively communicate the arguments they devised. Alternatively, parents might have sought the services of a philosopher. Like sophists, philosophers taught persuasive techniques, but unlike sophists, they eschewed appeals to emotion. Also, unlike sophists, philosophers thought that besides teaching their pupils how to persuade, they should teach them how to live well. Consequently, according to the historian H. I. Maru, in their teaching they emphasized the moral aspect of education, the development of the personality and the inner life. In the course of doing this, many philosophers provided their pupils with a philosophy of life. They taught them what things in life were worth pursuing and how best to pursue them. Some of the parents who wanted a philosophical education for their child hired a philosopher to act as live-in tutor. Aristotle, for example, was hired by King Philip of Macedon to tutor Alexander, who subsequently became the Great. Parents who could not afford a private tutor would have sent their sons, but probably not their daughters, to a school of philosophy. After the death of Socrates, these schools became a prominent feature of Athenian culture, and when, in the 2nd century BC, Rome came under the spell of Athenian culture, schools of philosophy started appearing in Rome as well. There are no longer schools of philosophy, and this is a shame. It is true that philosophy is still done within schools, more precisely, within the philosophy departments of universities, but the cultural role played by philosophy departments is quite unlike the role played by the ancient philosophical schools. For one thing, those who sign up for the philosophy classes offered by universities are rarely motivated to do so by a desire to acquire a philosophy of life. Instead, they take classes because their advisor tells them that if they don't, they can't graduate. And, if they do seek a philosophy of life, they would, in most universities, have a hard time finding a class that would offer them one. But, even though schools of philosophy are a thing of the past, people are in as much need of a philosophy of life as they ever were. The question is, where can they go to obtain one? If they go to the philosophy department of the local university, they will, as I have explained, probably be disappointed. What if they instead turn to their local church? Their pastor might tell them what they must do to be a good person, that is, what they must do to be morally upstanding. They might be instructed, for example, not to steal or tell lies, or, in some religions, have an abortion. Their pastor will also probably explain what they must do to have a good afterlife. They should come to services regularly, and pray, and, in some religions, tithe. But their pastor will probably have relatively little to say on what they must do to have a good life. Indeed, most religions, after telling adherents what they must do to be morally upstanding and get into heaven, leave it to them to determine what things in life are and aren't worth pursuing. These religions see nothing wrong with an adherent working hard so he can afford a huge mansion and an expensive sports car, as long as he doesn't break any laws doing so. Nor do they see anything wrong with the adherent forsaking the mansion for a hut and forsaking the car for a bicycle. And if religions do offer adherents advice on what things in life are and aren't worth pursuing, they tend to offer the advice in such a low-key manner that adherents might regard it as a suggestion rather than a directive about how to live, and might therefore ignore the advice. This, one imagines, is why the adherents of the various religions, despite the differences in their religious beliefs, end up with the same impromptu philosophy of life, namely a form of enlightened hedonism. Thus, although Lutherans, Baptists, Jews, Mormons, and Catholics hold different religious views, they are remarkably alike when encountered outside of church or synagogue. They hold similar jobs and have similar career ambitions. They live in similar homes, furnished in a similar manner. And they lust to the same degree for whatever consumer products are currently in vogue. It is clearly possible for a religion to require its adherents to adopt a particular philosophy of life. Consider, by way of illustration, the Hutterite religion, which teaches its adherents that one of the most valuable things in life is a sense of community. Hutterites are therefore forbidden to own private property, the rationale being that such ownership would give rise to feelings of envy, which in turn would disrupt the sense of community the Hutterites value. We can, of course, question whether this is a sound philosophy of life. Most religions, however, don't require their adherents to adopt a particular philosophy of life. As long as adherents don't harm others and don't do things to anger God, they are free to live their life as they will. Indeed, if the Hutterite religion seems both extreme and exotic to most people, it is because they can't imagine belonging to a religion that tells them how to live their life. What this means is that it is entirely possible these days for someone to have been raised in a religion and to have taken philosophy courses in college, but still to be lacking a philosophy of life. Indeed, this is the situation in which most of my students find themselves. What, then, should those seeking a philosophy of life do? Perhaps their best option is to create for themselves a virtual school of philosophy by reading the works of the philosophers who ran the ancient schools. This, at any rate, is what, in the following pages, I will be encouraging readers to do. In ancient Greece, when schools of philosophy were still prominent features of the cultural landscape, there were any number of schools to which parents could send their children. Suppose we could travel back in time to 300 BC and take a thinking person's walking tour of Athens. We could begin our tour in the Agora, where Socrates, a century earlier, had philosophized with the citizens of Athens. On the northern side of the Agora, we would see the Stoa Pikili, or painted porch, and holding forth there might be Zeno of Sicium, the founder of the Stoic school of philosophy. This porch was actually a colonnade decorated with murals. As we walked through Athens, we might come across the Cynic philosopher Crates, whose school of philosophy Zeno had once attended. Although the first Cynics met near the gymnasium of Cynosarges, hence their name, they could be found anywhere in Athens, attempting to draw, or drag if need be, ordinary people into philosophical discussions. Furthermore, whereas parents might have willingly sent their children to study with Zeno, it is unlikely that they encouraged them to become Cynics, inasmuch as Cynic doctrines, if successfully internalized, would guarantee their child a life of ignominious poverty. Heading northwest and leaving the city by Dipulon Gate, we would come to the Garden of the Epicureans, presided over by Epicurus himself. Whereas the Painted Porch was in an urban setting, with Stoic lectures periodically interrupted, one imagines, by noise from the street or the comments of passers-by, Epicurus's garden had a distinctly rural feel. The garden was, in fact, a working garden in which the Epicureans grew their own vegetables. Continuing toward the northwest, about a mile from the Agora, we would come to the Academy, the school of philosophy founded by Plato in 387 BC, a bit more than a decade after the death of Socrates. Like Epicurus's garden, the Academy would have been a striking place in which to philosophize. It was a park-like retreat, furnished with walks and fountains. On the Academy grounds were buildings, paid for by Plato and his friends. Holding forth there in 300 BC might have been Polemo, who had inherited the position of master of the school. The Stoic philosopher Zeno, as we shall see, attended Polemo's school for a time. Doubling back, going through the city again, and exiting the city gates into the eastern suburbs of Athens, we would have come to the Lyceum. In this wooded area, near a shrine to Apollo Lykios, we could see the Peripatetics, disciples of Aristotle, walking and talking, and at the head of the group might be Theophrastus. But this is only the beginning of the educational options open to ancient parents. Besides the schools mentioned in connection with our walking tour, there were the Cyrenaic, Skeptic, Megarian, and Elean schools mentioned earlier, to which we can add several other schools mentioned by Diogenes Laertius, including the Eretrian, Anassarian, and Theodorian schools, along with the schools run by the Eudaimonists, the truth lovers, the refutationists, the reasoners from analogy, the physicists, the moralists, and the dialecticians. As it so happens, young men, and rarely young women, weren't the only ones to attend schools of philosophy. Sometimes fathers studied alongside their sons. In other cases, adults attended a school's lectures by themselves. Perhaps they had attended a school as a youth and now sought continuing education in the philosophy of life taught by that school. Other adults, though never having belonged to a school, might have attended its lectures as guests. Their motives were probably very much like the motives modern individuals have in attending a public lecture. They sought to be enlightened and entertained. Yet other adults had an ulterior motive for attending schools of philosophy. They wanted to start their own school and listen to the lectures of heads of successful schools in order to borrow philosophical ideas they could use in their own teaching. Zeno of Sicyum was accused of doing just this. Polemo complained that Zeno's motive for attending lectures at the Academy was to steal his doctrines. The rival schools of philosophy differed in the subjects they taught. The early Stoics, for example, were interested not only in a philosophy of life, but in physics and logic as well, for the simple reason that they thought these areas of study were inherently entwined. The Epicureans shared the Stoics' interest in physics, although they had different views about the physical world than the Stoics did, but did not likewise share their interest in logic. The Cyrenaics and Cynics were interested in neither physics nor logic. At their schools, all one was taught was a philosophy of life. Those schools that offered students a philosophy of life differed in the philosophy they recommended. The Cyrenaics, for example, thought the grand goal in living was the experience of pleasure, and therefore advocated taking advantage of every opportunity to experience it. The Cynics advocated an ascetic lifestyle. If you want a good life, they argued, You must learn to want next to nothing. The Stoics fell somewhere between the Cyrenaics and the Cynics. They thought people should enjoy the good things life has to offer, including friendship and wealth, but only if they did not cling to these good things. Indeed, they thought we should periodically interrupt our enjoyment of what life has to offer to spend time contemplating the loss of whatever it is we are enjoying. Affiliating oneself with a school of philosophy was a serious business. According to the historian Simon Price, adherence to a philosophical sect was not simply a matter for the mind, or the result of mere intellectual fashion. Those who took their philosophy seriously attempted to live that philosophy from day to day. And, just as a modern individual's religion can become the key element of his personal identity, think of a born-again Christian, an ancient Greek's or Roman's philosophical association became an important part of who he was. According to the historian Paul Vane, to truly be a philosopher was to live out the sect's doctrine, conform one's conduct, and even one's attire, to it, and if need be, to die for it. Readers of this book should therefore keep in mind that although I am advocating Stoicism as a philosophy of life, it isn't the only option available to those seeking such a philosophy. Furthermore, although the Stoics thought they could prove that theirs was the correct philosophy of life, I don't, as we shall see in Chapter 21, think such a proof is possible. Instead, I think that which philosophy of life a person should choose depends on her personality and circumstances. But, having made this admission, let me add that I think there are very many people whose personality and circumstances make them wonderful candidates for the practice of Stoicism. Furthermore, whatever philosophy of life a person ends up adopting, she will probably have a better life than if she tried to live, as many people do, without a coherent philosophy of life.